Welcome to the Security Serengeti. We're your hosts, David Schwindiger and Matthew Keener. Stop what you're doing, subscribe to our podcast, leave us a lovely five-star review, and follow us at SerengetiSec on Twitter. And who knows, I might check it one day.
There's always hope.
Always hope.
We're here to talk about cybersecurity and technology news headlines, and hopefully it provides some insight, analysis, and practical application that you can take into the office to help protect your organization.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are ours and ours alone and do not reflect the views or opinions of our employers or each other.
Hey, we've heard news of a potentially compromised snowflake. If Philip K. Dick were writing this storyline, it would be snowflakes of the third variety.
That's right. It's not the kind of snowflake you're thinking of. And it's not the other kind of snowflake you're thinking of either.
It is that kind of snowflake.
Kind of snowflake.
All right. Well, before we get to talk about snowflakes, we're going to talk about the White House.
Man, way to lead people on.
That just goes right in there, White House and snowflakes. Mm-hmm. All right. So White House report dishes out deets on all 11 major government breaches from 2023.
What a news headline. Where is that from?
Oh, can you believe it's from the Register?
My gosh.
All right. So apparently there were 32,211 cybersecurity incidents in 2023 per the White House report, which is entitled Federal Information Security Modernization Act of 2014 Annual Report Fiscal Year 2023.
That is a really loose definition of, quote, incident.
Well, it is the government. They are relatively loose with their stat, their facts, and their anything they say, really.
The truth.
All right. So they've broken down the categories of the incidents into, I think it's, into nine different categories. So the one which was the most populous was improper usage. So they had 12,261 of those.
And that's got to be people visiting inappropriate websites and using work computers for personal stuff, stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. The next one is phishing / malicious emails. And there were 6,198 of those. Now that sounds like a pretty good number, actually, because the government employs 4 million people. So that's less than 0.2%, which is totally believable that that's all they had out of 4 million users.
Yeah, that's got to be confirmed clicks, right? Folks that opened up the email and clicked on the link. That's the only way that would be even close to that low. But what I find interesting is that most phishing training companies, they'll claim, or you'll see when you do a phishing training, like somewhere between 5 and 10% of people is kind of the normal click-through rate. Does this mean that the attackers that are going after the government are really bad at their jobs, or the government is really good at their training, or someone is lying about this?
Well, I'll let you guess which one of those three I think is accurate.
Actually, you know what? They may not have to be lying about it. It may be that their coverage is extremely poor. You know, if they don't have a proxy or if they don't have proxy links in their email, they may not know the vast majority of clicks. This may be just the number of clicks they were able to detect.
Oh, right. Never, so if we never, move that never, up.
Yeah, sorry.
So there's potentially, let's see, 30,000 that they don't know about then?
Yeah, somewhere. Yeah, some number that they just don't know about. Because as we'll talk about later, IDS and IPS is not part of their current modernization. I didn't check to see if proxy coverage is part of their current modernization, but if they're not currently prioritizing IDS and IPS, then I bet proxy is not a big one either.
Yeah, it's flavor of the month with them.
Yeah, they're currently still working on deploying EDR everywhere, so.
Well, EDR is the latest thing.
Yeah.
All right, next category is unknown.
That's a weird one. Why didn't they just leave it as other? Why would they add unknown?
Because they were compromised, but they don't know how they became compromised, guessing.
Yeah, maybe. This is where all the X-Files stuff goes in.
Right. So it's all in the basement of the Pentagon. So there's 5,687 of those. Next is web-based attacks with 3,569. Theft or loss of equipment, 3,135. And the article pointed out that it would be interesting to see actually what the breakdown there is of how much was theft and how much was lost. My guess is that 3,000 of those at least were laptops left on the metro.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but
This happens just about every day. The next one is attrition slash brute force, which is 1,147. And then from there, there's a precipitous drop.
Hold on. Let's talk about the attrition brute force. That has got to be successful brute forces, right? Because otherwise it wouldn't, if there was just somebody doing a brute force on them, it wouldn't be an incident and that would number in the millions.
Right.
So that is actually a lot of successful brute forces.
Yeah, it's interesting, though, that they had this many brute forces, which means they had that many account compromises. And yet, when we get down into the incidents, the 11 major incidents or whatever, none of them are tied to a brute force.
No, they're not. So
that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. That just means we know that they caught it immediately and remediated it.
Or as I saw in the Army all the time, it was just a test account. No big deal.
They're all test accounts if you're a private.
Yeah, test accounts or test systems all the time. But there's a precipitous drop from that 1,100 down to the next one, which is multiple vectors, and that's only 92, followed by removal media, which is also 92, and then finally impersonation, which is 30. Now, when we talk about the impact of all of these incidents, to quote the article, none registered higher than medium on the National Cyber Incident Scoring System, NCISS.
That sounds like a TV show.
Yeah, it does sound very much like a TV show for some reason. Okay, which acts as the CVSS for individual vulnerabilities and grade incidents according to how impactful they're likely to be on aspects of society, such as national and economic security, delivering public services, and foreign relations. I thought that was weird. The impact to aspects of society. I mean, most people can't even define what society is. And yet they're using this in their definition of what's impactful for a security incident. So when you break down the impacts, you have 31,621, which were highly unlikely to affect society, 348, which were low, unlikely to affect society, 229 uncategorized, which is weird to say that there's not enough info to determine whether it impacts society or not, I guess. And then finally, 31 for the medium, which may affect society.
So those are the ones that got into the JFK records and...
Yeah, I don't think the CIA is included in any of this list, so probably not the JFK records.
That's fair. Oh, the CIA wouldn't talk about what breaches they've had.
No, except for the Vault 7.
Yeah, well, that was public.
Yeah, but of those 31, they only categorize 11 as major incidents, and they define major incidents as one of the following: any incident that is likely to result in demonstrable harm to national security interests, foreign relations, or the economy of the United States, or to the public confidence, civil liberties, or public health and safety of the American people.
Civil liberties. Interesting. So like if it came out that, never mind, I'm not even going to speculate.
Yeah, if you had some malware that was racist, then it would be a major incident.
I was more talking about like some of the FBI's internal surveillance. Would be very interesting and would probably, that would be a breach that would potentially cause.
Well, that's the FBI breaking into other people's computers though. All right. So the other possible definition of what a major incident would be: a breach that involves personally identifiable information that, if exfiltrated, modified, deleted, or otherwise compromised, is likely to result in demonstrable harm to national security interests, foreign relations, or the economy of the United States, or to the public confidence, civil liberties, or public health and safety of the American people.
Public health one's interesting too. What kind of, I guess it'd be like anthrax or something like that.
No, I think that's just a breach of any of the public health establishment, which is actually in the list of major incidents is the HHS, which is what we're going to talk about here. We're going to go through these 11 breaches here.
And are they gripping?
Oh, they're riveting, but we'll be run through them pretty fast because there's not actually a lot of information here about them. The first two were from the Department of Health and Human Services. So they had a ransomware attack on a contractor who was responsible for the Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which exposed the personal identifiable information of 2.8 million people, half of which were dead.
Well,
so I guess
good
I guess
for them.
1.4, really? I'm pretty sure dead people are not concerned about how much PII was compromised of theirs.
Yeah, I actually, when I first read this, I was like, oh, this contract. And then I realized that a lot of these are contractors. And I was like, oh, wait, that's just how the government does all the work. So not actually
right.
a surprise.
Yeah, outsource everything. Because how are you going to pay contracting companies if you don't have contractors? And the second breach was there were two, I guess these were part of one incident, but two systems were targeted by attackers using a zero day, which exposed the PII of 1.8 million people. So it's pretty interesting that they spent a zero day on compromising HHS.
Well, that just means that it's been used elsewhere and it wasn't caught.
No, that could be. Because generally you don't want to burn your zero day unless you're going to get a high payoff. So they must have expected quite a bit out of that. All right. The next two were compromised at the Department of Treasury. So the first one is the IRS. I'm so sad.
Very sad.
I'm holding back tears. So the 990-T forms were compromised. The vendor did not, the vendor that was responsible for managing these forms did not delete data from a staging server. But what was interesting about that one is technically that is not in FY23 because it happened in September of 22 and the fiscal year for the government doesn't start until October of 23.
They just didn't report it in time to make last year's report.
I guess. And the other compromise at Treasury was an employee at the Office of the Inspector General unwittingly handed their login credentials after being phished by a overseas state-sponsored attacker.
Always state-sponsored.
Yeah. But luckily, after they unwittingly handed over their credentials, they were able to stop the compromise before any lateral movement took place within 15 hours.
Yeah. This is interesting. So there were 6,000 quote-unquote phishing incidents, and then there's also the 1,000-plus brute force attacks. And this is the only one of them where somebody's credentials were compromised, and they mention it. And I don't know why. I don't know if it's because there was more sensitive data available on this laptop, like maybe there was PII on the laptop, so therefore they felt like they had to report it, or I don't know what makes this one worse. State-sponsored actor, maybe?
Well, I mean, they categorize anybody they want as a state-sponsored attacker.
Yeah.
But I think that the thing is that with their all their definitions, everything, there's so much wiggle room in there that they really did decide what they want to report as what.
That's fair.
But the next one is the Justice Department was the target of two incidents also. One was the U.S. Marshal Service was ransomware. And the second one is vendors applying data analytics support for cases, which led to the compromise of personal and medical data.
Analytics support. Interesting. That compromised medical data. Wonder if it was related to like a crime lab or something.
Yeah.
I guess analytic data can be any number of things. It does say case analytic data analytics support for cases. Weird.
All right. So maybe it's forensic data?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking initially. I don't know.
Yeah, you would think that forensic data relating to cases would not be online.
No, it's got to be. Everything's online these days.
Yeah. That's a good point. I mean, what's the point of having it if it's not online?
Yeah, people expect immediate access to it afterwards. They don't wait for the mail to come through.
All right. The next one is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. So they had an insider send 14 emails, two of which contain two spreadsheets, which with the PII of 256 consumers. And apparently they mailed this to a financial institution.
That's really weird. Sent 14 emails.
Not sure what's going on there.
Well, it says that the 256,000 consumers, the consumers were linked to a financial institution. This is probably related to an investigation that they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah.
All right. And the next one, Park and Transit Benefit System. So 273,000 people were potentially affected after several administrative systems were breached and personal data was stolen. And this was a compromise due to an unpatched and a critical vulnerability. And the next one, everybody's favorite office, the Office of Personnel Management.
Again.
Yeah, this one's a little bit smaller than the 15 million SF-86s that they gave to the Chinese. But an OPM contractor was using MoveIt, and this is related to the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey. And this allowed the unauthorized access of data belonging to 632,000 employees at the Department of Justice and Defense. But I looked at to see what the Federal Employee Viewpoint Survey is. That's their bitching survey about how happy they are to be government employees or how unhappy they are to be government employees.
Guess it's not anonymous anymore.
Not after that. I don't think it was probably never anonymous. I would never trust the government to do anything anonymously correctly. All right. So the last one is the DOE, Department of Energy. So this appears to be another also MoveIt related incident where their waste isolation pilot plant and the Oak Ridge Associated Universities were compromised. So they had 34,000 former DOE workers covered by a program to support those who may have been exposed to dangerous substances like nuclear waste, had their personal and health data exposed. And also 66,000 people from the Office of Science were also part of that. So in total, almost 100,000.
So this is interesting. Just looking over these. So you have two MoveIt related ones. We have one for exploiting an unpatched critical vulnerability. We have one insider. We have two ransomwares. And we have one phishing and one 0 day. And then the Internal Revenue Service, that wasn't really an incident. That was the vendor didn't delete the data from a server. It was more like a mistake or a misuse.
Yeah, inadvertent exposure.
Yeah, I guess that's a pretty wide variety of items. I mean, two ransomware, one phishing, one exploited vulnerability, two MoveIt. Yeah, it's pretty. I was hoping that there would be enough of a pattern that we could draw something interesting from that, but I don't think there is. I think there's just the government has a wide footprint and they're vulnerable to a variety of attacks.
Yeah, and this was all generated by AI, so.
All right. I found a couple other interesting quotes in the report I pulled out that I found interesting. I tried to read through the whole report. It was 37 pages. I didn't quite have time to hit all of it. But they talk a lot in the first half of the report about their zero trust initiative. They're trying to get the government into zero trust.
Well, and I already have zero trust in them. So I think they've already finished that.
Accomplished their goal. Well, there's still people in the United States that do trust the government. So, what's interesting to me is everybody that I haven't heard of any company successfully fully deploying zero trust, but the government on their own self-reported report card, most of their agencies are reporting that they are well on their way and they're in the green and they're making it to zero trust. Maybe in a future episode, we can go through what exactly that means. Cause I'm wondering if their zero trust doesn't mean what we think zero trust means.
Mm. Yeah. Well, either that or the Office of Zero Trust is co-located with the unicorn containment unit.
Right next to the X-Files. All right. So two other ones that I found really interesting. They made mention in here that in fiscal year 2023, they procured 1.2 million EDR licenses to cover gaps in various agencies. That blows my mind that the government is still rolling out EDR to all their systems. They are a decade behind.
Well, they said procured too. They didn't say installed or deployed.
Yeah, they said they did
so
say
they just bought them.
Yeah, and they said deployed for 750,000. So they bought 1.2 million. They deployed 750,000. So you're right, but they're like, that blows my mind. The second part of this was the intrusion prevention and intrusion detection systems, IDS, IPS, are not part of this zero trust project. They're not part of the scope of this. Not in scope of the CADS program, which is the automating this. And I find this, well, again, this is wild. This is incredibly behind the times. Frankly, IDS IPS is before EDR. I don't know why they're putting it off until afterwards or not deploying them simultaneously. These are big agencies with big IT departments.
Well, my speculation would be that they see EDR as being pivotal to zero trust, but not IDS IPS.
Yeah, so I mean, there's something
that
in there
might
about,
be why it's not that big a deal for them.
Yeah, there's something there about remote work. And, you know, folks are not on the networks as much. They're working from home. They're working from coffee shops, et cetera. But you can still do IDS, IPS with something like a Palo Alto Prisma Access or something.
Well, I don't know.
Force the everyone to go through your network.
Thing is, this is 2024. If they don't have IDS and IPS deployed already.
Perfect. Then
forget
maybe
about
it's
it.
Not. Yeah, then maybe it's not worth prioritizing that. That's fine.
I mean, it's not like IPS IDS is new.
No, it's not.
I mean, EDR, it's only a decade old now. You can't expect them to have that done yet.
You're right. Maybe they're only 8 years out of date on that one. My bad.
Not quite
a full decade.
Yeah. I mean, we talked about, I think it was in our last podcast, we were saying, what's the definition of recent?
Yeah.
But the reason that I thought this was somewhat interesting is, you know what is missing from this report?
My raise.
Tax cut. You know.
There's a lot of things from this report.
But you may have recalled that the Chinese hackers stole 60,000 emails from the Department of State in May due to that Microsoft Cloud Exchange breach.
Is that fiscal?
In May of 23.
Oh, okay.
So that is right in the center of fiscal year 23. So I guess that was not a major incident. Had no impact on foreign relations or
yeah,
society.
Had no impact on health services or, you know, civil order. So
no, it's the State Department.
Yeah, not important.
So it's probably all emails about who we're going to fight next. But I think it just demonstrates that, you know, they're liars because they're probably justifying not including this in this because of all the wiggle room in their loose language with what needs to be in the report. So there are probably numerous other incidents far worse than what we're talking about here. I mean, we just touched on the phishing thing, how the numbers don't even seem, would not even make sense in a phishing scenario. So.
Or the brute force one. 1,100 successful brute forces and not a single one got enough access to make the major incident list.
Or even rate as a medium as far as the impact goes. It just doesn't, the numbers are just not adding up. So there are probably like I said, dozens or more that you're never going to hear about that are far worse than any of these. And the only reason you hear about these is because they're relatively benign, not so bad.
This is the whole thing where they ask you in an interview, like, what's your biggest weakness? And you find something that you're like, oh, but it's secretly a superpower.
Right.
This is exactly what this is.
I'm much
they made
too
a mistake,
detail oriented. But... That's the problem. Yeah.
I'm not going to mention the rest of it. Let's just move on.
All right.
So
well,
next
that's
one.
It for this one.
That's it for that one. Next, we are going to talk about Snowflake. I know all you guys are excited to hear our opinions on it, and we made you wait for 20 minutes of talk about boring government intrusions. And I am killing yet more time, making you wait even.
So you skip that over just like the ads.
Yeah, I ended up picking one of the Register articles as the headline for this. Snowflake customers not using MFA are not unique. Over 165 of them have been compromised, but there's any number of articles out there. You've all seen them. Everyone knows about Snowflake. It's been all over the news. We're not going to dive into the intrusion itself. You've probably heard that on other podcasts. Our thousands of listeners who are deeply entrenched in the security industry. But we're going to talk instead about what lessons can be learned and maybe some of the stuff kind of around the periphery of this. As of recording, as of the articles we picked up yesterday, Friday the 14th, 165 organizations that use Snowflake, a cloud data storage processing and analysis platform, have been compromised, and a quote-unquote significant volume of records has been exfiltrated. The earliest known date of the issue was April 14th. Attackers used legitimate credentials from Infos dealers to log in, even though there were some early reports that Snowflake itself was compromised, which turned out to only be partially true. There was apparently a test account that was one of these legitimate credentials from Infos dealers. Hudson Rock originally published an investigation. They published it a day after the Snowflake advisory, judging by the dates on these various things. They've now removed their original investigation because they said they spoke to the seller of the information who were trying to get a $20 million ransom from Snowflake. And the person they talked to lied to them and told them that they had gotten this from that test Snowflake account. Mandiant, at the point of time that this was revealed, I think it was on May 31st, had already been investigating for like a month. So there was a lot of incorrect information the first week or so.
I transposed their names every time I read through this in the article. Reading that Rock Hudson had originally published the report.
You're like, wow, he's dead.
He's like been dead for a long time, yet he's still publishing cybersecurity reports.
I mean, that's what makes him so good. He's the original Zero Cool. He's living online now. I don't know where he's going with that. He's in the ether. Yeah, he's all right. So my first discussion point kind of in here is more around the info stealer part. This makes me wonder how many of your organization's cloud/SaaS credentials are just out there and stolen via info stealer, but haven't taken advantage of yet.
Or maybe they have been taken advantage of.
Yeah. Is this something where the attackers have been using these credentials for years, but it just hasn't hit the news? Like companies have kept it quiet. And so nobody really knows that this is a thing.
Well, here's the thing, and we'll kind of get into this into the what you can do about it, though. But SaaS logging is notoriously bad, right? So if they're using legitimate credentials to log into a SaaS platform,
as long as they don't do anything that
raises a lot of alarm bells, they could be in there for a long time reading stuff, downloading stuff even, who's going to know?
That's fair. I was, I don't know, I wasn't sure if it was that or that they were focused in the past on certain types of credentials, such as bank accounts or business email that are easier to monetize. Like if you break into a bank account, you just transfer the money out. You break into a business email account, you can do all kinds of business email compromise related fraud. And now they're kind of like, oh, this is getting harder. How do we expand our scope? How do we make money off these things we already have?
Right.
Yeah, the fact that some of the credentials were from 2020 lends some credence to this to me. But again, like you said, the logging is so bad. Maybe they've just been in there forever, and this was the first actor who really decided to try and monetize it and get that ransom. It wouldn't surprise me if state actors had been doing this for quite a while, because since they're not financially motivated, that would make so much more sense that you would just never know that they were there.
Right.
You know, they're just quietly siphoning off the information and giggling to themselves.
Right, because they're not incentivized to monetize it, at which point that's when it becomes apparent that something has occurred versus simply obtaining information that's present in whatever SaaS solution we're talking about.
Yeah. So my personal opinion here is that we are going to see a run on SaaS systems by attackers. Now that someone has publicly done this, there are going to be a whole bunch of criminal gangs out there. And maybe we're too late. Maybe this is already happening.
Well, I think maybe what we might see happen out of this but I guess it'd be yet to be seen, is that we'll find out more about this kind of activity that's taking place, because maybe SaaS vendors or SaaS customers will start pushing on their SaaS providers to get more information about what's going on in there, and you get better logging, and you have more visibility of these potential compromises. And it's not the fact that, you know, attackers are going to be doing more of this so much as it will be more visible.
I think there's room for both, because I think there's room for the JV teams of criminals that are now going to be like, oh, I can log into this SaaS system and ransom and maybe make an extra couple $100,000. But you're right. I think you are also going to see, you know, as you start logging, you're going to find that a bunch of these SaaS platforms that you thought were totally hunky-dory, you're going to discover or not. So, although the really smart ones are going to know that, and they're going to be like, all right, let's get what we need and let's get out of here and not log back in. Because now that there's an eye on this.
Just avoid getting caught.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds to me like we're not resetting enough credentials when we detect malware on a system. I mean, I know I've typically seen in the past, you detect malware on the system, you reset the work accounts. You might tell them like, oh, you should reset, you know, if you do any banking on the system, you should reset your credentials on that. But maybe there are other places that do this better, but are you doing full on inventories? Like, asking the user or checking their password vault and being like, all right, you got to reset all these credentials. I mean, that's a thing.
I mean, do you even have a password vault for your employees?
That's a fair one, but you should. Everyone should have a password vault. It's 2024.
Okay. You keep wishing that, Matt.
Although, does a password vault actually make this worse? I don't know how the info stealers work when it comes to password vaults. Does it only access, like when you log into a password vault? I mean, I guess they could technically exfiltrate the password vault and they could keylog your password to get into the vault. So I guess you do have to assume that everything in the vault's compromised.
Well, it depends on how the stealer works. You know, if it's just a keystroke logger, then it's only going to get what keystrokes it gets. And depending on the nature of the password vault, they won't be able to log into the password vault to get everything else. I haven't yet to hear of.
To even log in. No.
Well, I mean, what would be a good info stealer, though, is one that identified the fact that Password Vault was there. And then once it got the credentials for the vault, then downloaded the vault.
Yeah. Yep. That would be a real pain because a lot of these vaults, too, you have shared credentials.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. For every, you know, the, oh, here's the admin account for our ED. It's in the password vault. It's shared so everybody can access it.
Right. Here's all our service account passwords.
That would be a problem.
Yeah. That could be ugly.
So, but yeah, that was, so I would definitely, so that's where threat intel comes in, right? You find the info stealer malware and you're like, all right, this is an info stealer malware. But like David said, what does it do? Does it steal password vaults? There may be some more call for actual malware reverse engineering as opposed to, you know, a lot of companies, I'm sure listeners have worked at these companies where when you find malware in a system, you hit it with malware bytes or a safety scanner or whatever, rebuild the system. And you're like, all right, back to the races. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
You may not want to do that. You may want to figure out actually what it's doing.
Right. And if these info stealers got, you know, if the accounts which were compromised at Snowflake were SSO accounts too, that means that those credentials are also corporate credentials that were compromised.
I think that's actually safer though, because that makes it a lot easier with SSO. You only have to change one set of credentials versus 20 or 30 or 50 or 1,000.
Is if they have the SSO credentials for Snowflake, then they've got the corporate credentials. So what other avenues can they leverage corporate credentials for? You know, if they don't have MFA on the remote access, can they use those corporate credentials then just to remote into the network or, you know, what other SaaS solutions are for SSO?
Yeah, I'm sure that's what they were doing, though, is they were just trying to like RDP into it and get into their email and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah, the other SSO, the other SaaS stuff, I wonder if there's an easy way to tell that. I wonder if there's an easy way to tell what SaaS has been set up so you don't have to just try literally everything.
No idea.
Yeah, me neither. According to MTrends 2024, stolen credentials are responsible for 10% of breaches. I bet that's going to go up in 2024. And the MTrends 2025, I bet that goes up to 20%. So some of the credentials that were stolen were from 2020 and had not been rotated. How often are you updating your SaaS credentials? I know that corporate credentials are typically rotated every 90 days, or I think isn't the new guidance like 6 months to a year?
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like some of the SaaS stuff is not being updated anywhere near that. I actually have some experience with this. I have an account on a specific system from a vendor who will not be named, where there is no way to set a password update policy. In fact, there's no way to even change a password on this system. If you want to change the password, you have to delete and recreate the account. And this is from a
security
vendor. Holy cow. It is very interesting.
Yeah. Well, I've never managed a SaaS solution. They generally have those kind of configurations in there for companies.
Yeah, I've managed very few of them. So I can think, actually, you know what? I can think of another one that does not, that I've used the same password for. Does that one have SSO? I'm trying to remember. I don't think it does. I think I've used the same credentials for like 7 years.
Holy cow.
Yeah, maybe I need to go and reset some of my own credentials this coming week. Sorry, boss, can't do any work this week. I got 128 sets of credentials. You know, after the LastPass thing and I did reset all my credentials, that was a multi-week process. Not like continuously, but you know, an hour or two a day.
Yep.
Right. Some of the credentials were traced back to contractors who had access to multiple organizations, and they were using personal devices, which they then used for multiple different organizations that they were working on. Definitely something to highlight. If you have contractors, highly recommend that you ship them a laptop, even if it's only for a few weeks.
Yeah. I mean, especially if you're talking about a small contractor, like who's a sole proprietor or has their own LLC or whatever, you know, the line between work and personal device is probably very shady there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, their work device, they want the most powerful device for work. And then they're going to be like, got to set aside my MacBook Pro M2 so that I can, you know, get back on this Chromebook to highly doubtful they're doing that.
Right.
Is there any reason not to have MFA enabled for every single logon accessible outside of the org at this point in time?
I don't see one.
Yeah. Especially in the day of passkeys and stuff like YubiKeys and things like that. If everybody complains about MFA, then buy everybody a YubiKey.
I mean, even SMS is better than nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you'd have to be really valuable or really important to justify an attacker doing that interception. Anton Chivakin wrote an article about this. The important part I thought was he brought up kind of a mental exercise of how much responsibility does the vendor share based on how they treat additional security. Kind of on the vendor is mostly responsible spectrum, the vendor might not build in extra security, or alternatively, they might build it and then charge a bundle of money to use it, thus guaranteeing that hardly anybody uses it. That would definitely make the vendor more culpable. In the middle, there's, you know, gradation such as the extra security exists, but it's kind of hidden under documentation or options, or it's available in the UI, but by default it's off, or they, you know, do some of that nudge stuff to try and, or make it a choice when you set up, do you want to turn this on? On the most secure end, the extra security is either default on or is the only choice. And we've seen Amazon go through this over the last decade. They started off making S3 buckets default open, and now they are default closed. And there's a lot of other security choices that they've made to make it more secure by just making the default the more secure one.
Yeah, I thought this was really interesting approach that Anton came up with here, showing that, you know, there's, as usual, no black and white, this is your fault, this is your fault. There are shades of gray on the line here, even in the shared security model, where supposedly we understand who's responsible for what.
Yeah. Shout out to Jay, one of my coworkers, who told me on Friday that apparently Snowflake does make it somewhat difficult to turn on MFA. It's an available option, but you apparently have to do some scripting to get it turned on. It's not just like a simple UI change.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I was so surprised to hear that.
That is bizarre.
That's a very interesting choice. Yeah, I've actually been thinking a lot about this, because this is something that comes up all the time in security, where you talk about, like, you know, oh, everybody participates in security and every employee is our last line of defense. And things shouldn't be like that. It should be secure by default. People shouldn't be able to, you know, destroy the whole company by clicking on a link in a phishing email.
Yeah, it's almost like process isolation, right? So mm-hmm. It used to be back in the day, if a program locked up, you had to reboot your computer because your whole computer was locked up because they didn't have really good process isolation.
Yeah.
Whereas now, when you've got a process that locks up, you know, you just have to kill that one process. The rest of your computer is fine. So we should consider security along those kind of same lines of, I mean, silos have a bad name, but, you know, being able to do proper isolation between what's really dangerous, or isolate dangerous activities or dangerous potential things that way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. I see that definitely as the future of security for sure. Because the way we're doing it now is just, it's we've talked about this before, like incident response and security operations and detections. And so much of security now is slapping a Band-Aid on stuff that was built default insecure.
Mm-hmm.
Or never patched or never updated. And it's just a money sink.
Right. It's the thing about never really addressing the root cause of the problem.
Yeah.
You know, because if you look back to, say, what was that? The credit rating agency that had the compromise because they failed to patch. I forget the company now. But the root cause of that is their entire vulnerability management process. It's not the fact that they failed to patch that one thing, right? Even though when they go back to the root cause of that compromise is this was not patched. Now, if that's as far as you go in determining what the root cause of the problem is, you're not getting to what the true root cause is. It's better to go through the whole five whys of root cause analysis to determine what was the true root cause of this. And maybe the ultimate root cause of it is your vulnerability management program is crap because you don't want to put money into it. You know, so it's actually a board decision or an executive decision that's the root cause of the compromise. Not failure to patch. It's not your vulnerability management program. It's, you know, leadership decisions that are the root cause of the problem. Unless you address those, you're never actually going to get better or prevent this kind of thing in the future. You're just band-aiding over it until the next time.
Yeah. All right. SpectreOps had an interesting post on the access model of Snowflake and the commands used to exfiltrate data. It makes an interesting read if you're not familiar with Snowflake, which I wasn't. It goes over the commands list in the mandate report, discusses how they work, gives a little more information. Both give some idea on how to detect an attack like this, especially with the staging of data and the exfiltration. Although they did use built-in commands, we're back to living off the land to stage and exfiltrate. So you can't just create a rule that says whenever somebody sets up a stage or whenever somebody copies data, because that's just gonna go wild. Mm-hmm. But you could probably look for reconnaissance commands. There were a bunch of commands like that listed out the contents of the tables, and then look for staging, recon plus staging maybe. But in this case, prevention is probably easier than detection. By the time you detect it, the exfiltration is probably ongoing. So
yeah, I think you and I may have talked about this before, about how with the expansion of the log bins, it's more and more important for security teams to be talking to the businesses about how they do business.
What are the commands you expect to see? What are the commands that, you know, are part of normal business, and then therefore what would not be?
In order to better identify when something hinky's going on.
So why does this matter? Every company uses SaaS these days, and SaaS databases especially are very high risk. And the last part was courtesy of David. What should you do about it? Reset every SaaS credential.
Now, right now. Stop what you're doing. Reset your path. Reset it.
Yeah, I'm overreacting. No, turn on MFA everywhere.
Yeah. And if you access, or if you can only access the SaaS solution from your corporate network, see if you can do IP restrictions on that access to the SaaS. If possible, get the logs from the SaaS into your SIM and monitor those like anything else, or maybe even more so. That's going to be a tough one based on my experience with SaaS vendors. Before you contract with a SaaS, make sure you know the state of their MFA and IP restrictions and logging capabilities. It would also be a good idea to sign up your organization for the Have I Been Pwned account, so you know if a corporate ID was compromised. You can get set up and get alerts and monitoring for that, and see if you can do this maybe also with your employees' personal accounts, because of the possibility of password reuse between their personal accounts and their corporate accounts. Train your employees to use a password manager and not to reuse passwords.
I'm curious if any password managers at a corporate level allow you to take inventory of the credentials stored in their URLs. I'm wondering if, for example, we're talking about Snowflake or, you know, Box or anything like that, if you can go into, you know, the corporate LastPass. Probably don't use that one, but I'll use it for the example. The corporate LastPass, and look like how many box.com credentials are stored in here. How many Snowflake credentials are stored in here? I don't know if that's possible. Probably not in the personal private part of the vault, but in the shared part, I would bet they would.
Right. And this is one of those things also where I think, you know, we're talking about threat intel. That would be a threat intel function I could see. Mm. That threat intel would be, this would kind of fall within the realm of threat intel of saying who's been compromised, and comparing those compromises to your SaaS inventory, essentially, to see how affected you are by that SaaS compromise.
That would be really interesting as well for the next one, because the next question is, do you have an inventory of SaaS platforms your company uses and who uses them? You probably have an official inventory, and then there's probably a separate inventory that doesn't exist of the shadow IT ones. And would you even know if one of these credentials was stolen by an info stealer? If you were able to do a password manager audit, you might be able to see, you know, oh, that's weird. We've got 47 sets of Box credentials that use corporate email addresses.
Yeah, and if you have a CASB can help you do that inventory of what SaaS platforms are being accessed, depending on which CASB you have.
Finally, be more aggressive, as I said, when you do password changes. Again, don't just change the work. Talk to the user, figure out what they have accessed. Especially if you can tell when the malware was installed, you know, if it was installed earlier today, then maybe you're good. If you look it up and you do some threat intel on the info stealer and it's just a keylogger, like, all right, great. You know, whatever you typed in the last 4 hours, although don't trust them, make them change more, because users will always lie.
No, come on now.
But be more aggressive. Like, don't just change the work password and then move on, because apparently they're getting a lot more than just your work email. They're getting those SaaS platforms. They may be getting the personal logins, bank accounts, LinkedIn, you know, social media, who knows? Be aggressive about it. That looks like that is all the articles we have for today. Thank you for joining us. Follow us at Serengeti Sec on Twitter and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.